Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry, carried out by the Australian Defence Force, reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian armed forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crime. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalists who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised. But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and there must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia, and there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot the prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. And what exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone. And so this order came most likely from the officers. And the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher-ups that I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is... On the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a very... This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against this these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murdered some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because they, for them, these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset
okay.
that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and the well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem. And it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided and the journalist was for a while threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that the result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists, who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Oh, I think certainly there will be prosecutions, whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, you know, crimes that not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war, because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this, because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government, and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is a problem of popular support that is very much lacking, popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population, a lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they have committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes, as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
Which we don't. What do you think about that, Brett? Things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed, or an Aussie soldier being killed, or a Brit being killed on the ground? isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics, even in international diplomacy. There is a massive issue that we have, what we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news. This goes on to dominate world politics for years sometimes, whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example, and in many cases those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders and certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, you know, George W. Bush, for example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize right before he went on to, you know, murder people in Syria and in Libya. So this is there is a massive hypocrisy at play here that is embedded in a way, of course, in the United Nations, very often in the veto power being wielded by certain permanent members of the Security Council.
All right. And on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be by your side.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRB English Radio. If you have been following this series of shows, we have been talking about the hadith and narrations around the topic of The Last Savior, and specifically the reason that the dreams can be looked at as a proof for the ordinary people. And we have discussed it that a dream can never be a proof for us to do anything or to act upon them at all. But with regard to those narrations that we have been talking about and analyzing, we have been actually also discussing the notion and concept of Akhir al-Zaman, the end of the time. And inshallah, in this very session, we shall continue this discussion, which have intermingled two topics, the topic of the dreams being a proof and also the end of the time, Akhir al-Zaman, in this session. Like always, we have invited respected researcher and scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, to the show. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikhuna. Okay, Sheikh, the question of the day that we are going to ask again, and to refer to the main question, is the authority of ru'ya or dream, and if the dreams can be looked at as a proof for us to act upon them. And this was the topic that we discussed earlier, and inshallah we shall be continuing talking about it at the time of occultation of Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And please tell us more on this concept. So if ru'ya and dreams cannot be looked at as proof, then why the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, at the time that he was alive, came to companions or in masjid and asking them that, is there any new dreams that you have to narrate to me, or alma mubashirat or alma mubashir? So how can we, Sheikh, digest this narrations and these facts that we have actually received from the Holy Prophet and others?
Thank you for raising this issue and referring to this narration, because the followers of dreams, those who want to prove their authenticity because of the dreams, refer to some narrations, and one of the main narrations is the one that you mentioned, which is quoted by Imam al-Rida alayhi salam. According to Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, he says, "Inna Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam kana idha asbah qala li ashabihi hal min mubashirat ya'ni bihi ru'ya." The Holy Prophet, in the morning, he used to ask his companions that hal min mubashirat, is there any, let's say, glad tidings? Ya'ni bihi ru'ya, the Holy Prophet meant dreams. So it seems that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet in the morning asked his companions that, did you have a dream last night in which you were given a glad tidings? First of all, let's talk about the concept of mubashirat. For sure, it's not related to a worldly issue. The Holy Prophet did not ask the Prophet, did you see a dream in which you saw that you have bought a camel or a house, and so on and so forth. It was about spiritual issues and the issues related to the hereafter, to the Day of Judgment. Now, we have different discussions to talk about regarding this narration. First of all, as I mentioned, mubashirat means glad tidings. Mm-hmm. So many people might see dreams in which they are given such glad tidings. But are all these glad tidings true? Or some of them can be satanic? We know that some dreams are, as they call it, satanic. They are affected by the influence of shaitan, the Satan. Now, even when it comes to mubashirat, we can think of the influence of the Satan. So, at the time of the Prophet, it was the responsibility of the Prophet to distinguish between the true glad tidings and the false glad tidings. Mm-hmm. So when the Prophet asks his companions that, did you see any mubashirat, any dream in which you were given glad tidings, it doesn't mean that the Holy Prophet wants to accept all the dreams.
True.
Or he wants to tell them that whatever you saw in the dream was true. It is very likely that the Holy Prophet wanted to ask his companions about the dreams and then to tell them that what you saw was true and this one was satanic, and so on and so forth. So we shouldn't think that all the mubashirat, all the glad tidings which are given to the believers are true. And I mentioned one narration in this regard. Main point here is that at the time of the Prophet, the companions, the Muslims, they had access to an infallible personality like the Prophet, and they were able to refer to him and ask him to distinguish between the true mubashirat and the false ones.
True.
But now in the time of the major occultation, we do not have access to an infallible imam. So we cannot say that because of this narration, which happened at the time of the Prophet, it applies to our time as well. This is not the case. But as I mentioned, not all the glad tidings are true. And of course, the infallible imam and the Prophet himself, they have given us some criteria to distinguish between the true ones and the false ones. So for example, in one narration, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, he says that, You should not be deceived by a dream that you see or other people see about you. Sometimes I do not see any dream. Another person comes to me and tells me that I saw in a dream that you are in such levels of paradise and so on and so forth. It's a kind of mubashir or glad tiding.
Okay, Sheikh, now that we don't have access to any of those holy entities, so whether we see some true dreams, so anyhow, there is no way for us to interpret it in the way that actually is the best possible way. Isn't it better to actually ignore this phase and leave it and say, okay, it cannot work for us at the time that we are living now for the time being? Based on all these explanations, so there must be a sort of infallible person to tell us what is the interpretation of these, to get sure that, for example, this dream was true or not.
There are two or three points that we have to take into consideration. First of all, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they have given us some criteria, as I mentioned, to let us know, to help us to distinguish between the false dreams and true dreams. And inshallah, later we will discuss that. It is about the time of the dream. It is about the content of a dream, if we may put it in this way, or the conditions before going to sleep. According to some narrations, you have to go to sleep while you have minor ablution or wudu in order for you to have true dreams. And so these conditions are mentioned in the narrations. So if the conditions are not there, we can make sure that the dream is not true. Or for example, according to some narrations, inshallah we'll discuss them in details, at the beginning of the night, the dream is not a true dream. So all these conditions, or many of these conditions and criteria, are discussed in the narrations, which can help us to distinguish between the true dream and false dream.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one my heart is to. I need you.
So we are not the one that actually can interpret it as the true dreams, then to make it as a proof to work, to act upon it, then.
That is my second point. The second point is that when we refer to the narrations, we cannot find any narration which tells us that your dream is a proof regarding your main beliefs.
So this is where we're going to reach, inshallah.
Yeah, exactly.
True. Thank you.
It is also mentioned in the narrations that it is not necessary for the people to act upon even their true dreams. So you see a true dream, and based on those criteria, you come to this conclusion that it is a true dream. But do you have to act upon that very true dream? The answer is negative. It is only the prophets and the imams for whom the dream is a kind of divine inspiration, like what happened to Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. So for them, it is a duty. But for us, fallible human beings, our dreams are not a proof, and they cannot force us to act upon them. Now, in this narration, the Holy Prophet says, you should not be deceived by the dream that you see or other people see about you. So what is the criterion? You see in a dream, in it, for example, you are given a glad tidings. The Holy Prophet says, you have to expose yourself to the Book of God, to the Noble Book of Quran. If you are such a person that act upon the Noble Book of Quran, if you are a very good, righteous person, then it is interesting. The Holy Prophet doesn't say that then you have to act upon that dream. He says that you can be happy because you were given this glad tidings that you are, for example, in heaven with the imams, with the prophet, in very high level of paradise. This is a mubasharat, a kind of mubasharat, a glad tidings. But after you wake up, you have been given a glad tiding in the dream. But when you expose yourself to the Noble Book of Quran, you see that you are not a person who acts upon the Noble Book of Quran. Then, in that case, you have to know that it was a satanic glad tiding. It was mubashir, it was a glad tiding, but it was given to you by the Satan.
Very true.
So the conclusion is that we see that many followers of these deviant groups in our time, the followers of these persons from Basra,
they refer to dreams.
They refer to dreams.
Make it a proof for themselves.
Exactly. For example, they say that I saw in a dream that I'm in the heaven, or I hear some voices which tell me that you will be in heaven, and so on and so forth. These dreams cannot be included in Mubasharat mentioned in these prophetic narrations, because as I mentioned before, that they have to expose themselves to the Noble Book of Quran and to see whether they are acting upon the Noble Book of Quran and the narrations, which we prove that they are not doing so. And second of all, there must be a person who can recognize between true Mubasharat and false Mubasharat. The Holy Prophet himself, who talks about Mubasharat in another narration, tells us that you have to know that that glad tiding, that dream, was a satanic one.
True.
And you should not be deceived by that.
We need to know that dreams cannot be a proof for us to actually judge based on these dreams and act upon them in our daily lives, and even in the glad tidings that we have for the appearance of Imam Zaman and actually the end of the time, with different interpretation, whether we consider it as the time of the reappearance of Imam or the day before Qiyamah or the resurrection.
Yeah, still I would like to talk about a few other points regarding this very narration, Halme Mubasharat. The other point is that glad tidings in the narrations, as I mentioned, and I would like to repeat that, is not bringing about a new law, a new belief, a new Islamic denominations. The Holy Prophet, when he asked his companions, he did not ask them, okay, did you see in a dream a new notion about God? Did you receive, a new Islamic law in your dream?
Rather, it was about their perfection or spiritual journey that
exactly.
they wanted to have.
So when
or not about bringing another prophet or imam in their life.
That's true. So when it comes to the followers of these groups, they adhere to this narration, and then they say that, okay, I saw in a dream that I was in paradise, and I was told that this is because you are following this certain person, like this person from Basra. The Holy Prophet, when he asked the companions, he did not mean that did you receive any revelation from God in which, for example, this Islamic law was abrogated, another one was revealed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Mubashir, glad tiding, is not musharrih, is not giving us a new religion, a new belief, a new Islamic law.
Rather, it is something for the spiritual journey that a person is going to take and for the betterment of his status in this world, not about the, let's say, the pillars of their religion or the imams or the prophets.
And the next point for this narration, let me repeat that we need an infallible imam for us to interpret the Mubasharat.
What is our duty when we don't have access to that infallible imam?
Then we cannot act upon them.
Better to leave it aside.
Yeah, we may refer to those criteria which we later mention, and they can give us some clue. At the end of the day, these Mubasharat, they will make us happy if you're acting upon the Noble Book of Quran, as mentioned by the Prophet. There is a very interesting narration about Hur, the famous companion of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was one of his enemies, and then he turned to his close companion. When he was going to go out of Kufa to fight Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he heard a voice, and that voice gave him the glad tidings of entering paradise.
True.
He says that when I went out, mutawajjihan nahwa al-Hussein, I was going to fight Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And that heavenly voice told me that, oh Hur, I'm giving you the glad tidings of entering paradise. So apparently, he comes to this conclusion that I'm given this glad tiding because I'm going to fight Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But is it true? Inshallah, I will discuss that in the following
session. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Yeah, that was a good, evidence for such controversial, claims that we can find among the different followers of different, let's say, Islamic sects. And this is good to be discussed, inshallah, in our upcoming session. Dear brothers and sisters, we have been talking about dreams and their authority to see if we can act upon them or not. They are all about to tell us that those who claim to be, for example, the Imam of the age or the followers of the Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they cannot have their claim based on some dreams. And dreams do not have that position and status to actually look at them in such a way. Thank you, Sheikh Murtada, for the explanations and your elaboration. And you, brothers and sisters, for your staying tuned and listening to this show. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjab bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states cease to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Cette manifestation était-elle autorisée?
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation, proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Ceux qui n'ont rien, pas même à toi.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, sheltered themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of this gathering, attended by political activists. On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians who have been suffering under more than 7 decades of Israel's occupation.
Those treacherous regimes have never cared about the interests of Muslims. They only seek to consolidate their foothold as rulers. I'm sure that the people of Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan do not share the stance of their regimes toward Israel. Muslims will never recognize Israel and its occupation of Palestine.
Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise and is solely a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises and lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players such as the U.S. never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an official visit to Afghanistan, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh is seeking to boost ties between Kabul and Tehran via expanding mutual cooperation, mainly in terms of peace and security.
Security of Afghanistan is of a high priority. We think that the security of two nations, Iran and Afghanistan, are very much connected to each other. So we think that through collaboration, through cooperation, we have to be able to secure a stable situation in Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman comes as many here believe Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and that is why players like Iran are struggling to keep their role in the country's peace and security.
Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and all regional players have developed new plans in line with their own interests. For instance, Daesh is replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to Kabul proves Iran's effort to expand its role in Afghanistan's security.
The visit of Iran's delegation comes as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parviz Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off. Although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity.